You are listening to Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances at the Los Angeles Central Library. I'm Louise Steinman from the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Today's conversation is part of Visualizing Language, Oaxaca in LA, an exhibition and program series presented by LFLA as part of the Getty's Pacific Standard Time, LALA initiative. From street art to Oaxacan cuisine, Visualizing Language presents free events throughout the city from September through January 2018. Visit lfla.org/Oaxaca to learn more, and please join us to see the new murals in Central Library or at a celebration of Oaxacan culture in a neighborhood library near you. There's one major aspect of the popular Gold Rush lore, and some of it's in that 1933 mural in the Rotunda, the top one, that few Californians today know about. During that period, California's Indian population plunged from perhaps 150,000 to 30,000, much of the decline from state-sponsored slaughter. And if you grew up in California as I did, I'm sure many of you did, I grew up here in the 50s, you probably didn't learn this fact in school. You probably didn't learn about state-sponsored genocide against Native Californians, about a state bounty on Indian scalps. You also probably did not learn about the incredible richness of Native California culture that was nearly destroyed by racism and the greed for gold. Today, the day after our first Indigenous Peoples Day, yes, we'll look at that history with UCLA professor Benjamin Madley, whose recent book is American Genocide, the United States, and the California Indian Catastrophe. And he has documented this history, this genocide of a vibrant civilization thousands of years in the making with, as Peter Nabokov noted, prosecutorial zeal. It's a brilliant, unsettling, and necessary book, and I hope you'll purchase a copy for your library or gift another Californian with a copy as a The title of tonight's program, of course, is both about that genocide and the resistance it met, and as well about the resilience and cultural revival of California Indians that takes us to the present moment. Greg Saris, scholar, author, and chairman of the Federated Indians of the Graton Rancheria, was going to be here with us tonight to speak to the latter, but alas, he had to evacuate his house at 2 a.m. This morning due to the fires in Santa Rosa, and to his great disappointment, he can't join us. But we will be reading from his lovely new book, just out from Heyday, called How a Mountain Was Made, inspired by traditional Coast Miwok and Southern Pomo creation tales, in his honor. And Greg, we're thinking of you and everyone affected by the fires tonight. So we will hear a lecture by Benjamin Madley, a historian of Native America, the United States, and colonialism in world history. Benjamin was born in Redding, California, and he spent much of his childhood in Carrick County, country near the Oregon border, where he first became interested in the relationship between colonizers and indigenous peoples. His book, An American Genocide, has received the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for History, the Raphael Lemkin Book Award from the Institute for the Study of Genocide, and the Heyday Books History Award, among many others. And we're thrilled to have him here with us tonight. And since we are indeed here tonight on Tongva land, we're going to begin our program with a traditional Tongva invocation, thanks to Tongva elder and educator Julia Bogany, who will be joining us shortly. Julia is a member of the Tongva Tribal Council and is their cultural consultant. She's worked for over 30 years for the American Indian community for her Tongva tribe. She helps to reawaken and revise the Tongva language and trains teachers and school boards on how to revise their curriculum to reflect the correct history of California and California tribes, so they won't have the experience that I did and many others as a student in California, hopefully in the near future. So let's welcome Benjamin Madley and Julia Bogany to the stage.
Good evening. I'm Julia Bogany, and I'd just like to do a short invocation, and I'd like to start off in my language. Tai honuka iyonak tehovetaha yovoi tohovetaha. I thank you, Creator, for this evening, for traveling mercies, and for each and every one that is here. Thank you for our host, and for Benjamin Madley, and for just being with us, and we just ask you to just help us to learn together. Wishkahe.
So good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for coming out tonight. Thank you, Julia, for those wonderful words of welcome. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge where we are. We are in Indian country. Wherever you go in the Los Angeles basin, as you drive home or you take the metro or ride in a bus, you will be in Indian country. Wherever you go in this state, wherever you go in this nation or this hemisphere, from the tip of Patagonia in the south to the shores of the Arctic Sea in the north, you will be in someone's ancestral homeland. If there's one thing that you take away this evening, I hope it will be an expanded consciousness of thinking about where you are and thinking about whose land you are on. The other thing I'd like to say by way of premise to begin this talk is that for some people in the audience, the trauma that we'll be discussing together tonight is a living experience. It's not something in the distant past from prior centuries. It is something that inhabits not only the dream world, but also sometimes the waking world. And these are very difficult stories that we will be discussing tonight, that I'll be sharing with you. If someone needs to get up for a prayer or just to get some fresh air outside, please be gracious and make way for them to leave where they're sitting and pass by you. The ceremony continued until just before dawn, illuminated by a central fire. The dancers moved together in ancient rhythms. The women's clamshell necklaces, as you see in this photograph here, clicking softly against their beaded shell dresses. Between the women, supporting them in their heavy ceremonial dance regalia, were men attired as hunters, as foxes, and as deer. Singers raised their voices skyward in the ancient melodies and words of Nidash, the feather dance. They were giving thanks not only for the original creation of this beautiful world in which we live, but for its continuous renewal, its remaking in each and every lived moment. Finally, the celebrants stopped just before dawn. They walked away arm in arm under a full moon. They made their way then through snug, round doorways into rectangular redwood plank houses with peaked roofs, buildings that look not so different from the houses in which many of us live today. Outside, the waters of Lake Earl lapped gently at the sandy shores. Inside, the Talawa Indian hosts and their guests, Yuroks from the south, other people from the north and west, they lay down and went to sleep, unaware that less than 8 miles away, white men were preparing to launch yet another expedition in California's ever-expanding killing machine. Crescent City's Coast Rangers and Klamath Mounted Rangers had been organized and well-armed by the state of California. California's elected governor, John Bigler, had provided them with 20 muskets, at least 90 rifles, and many thousands and thousands of rounds of ammunition. These California state militiamen now prepared to do one thing and one thing only: kill California Indian people. In the pre-dawn hours of the final day of 1854, as many as 116 of these militiamen, accompanied by an unknown number of volunteer auxiliaries, quietly surrounded the village, taking up concealed positions behind sand dunes, within brush, and behind boulders. As children, men, women and elders emerged from those snug redwood houses to begin their day, the militiamen and their auxiliaries opened fire. "We shot them down," says one eyewitness perpetrator, "just as fast as we could reload our weapons." A few Indian people ran and plunged into Lake Earl. They attempted to swim across, seeking safety on the opposite shore. There, too, they became targets. The best sharpshooters had been positioned on those opposite shores in order to shoot people down as they attempted to swim to safety. When the shooting and the screaming stopped, perhaps hundreds of people were dead. Not more than five survived the carnage. In contrast, the attackers apparently suffered only a single casualty, a wounded militiaman. And the state of California later paid these men for their so-called work. Now, as you heard earlier from Louise, between 1846 and 1870, California's Indian population plummeted from perhaps 150,000 people to not more than 30,000 individuals. Diseases, dislocation, exposure, and starvation all contributed to this population catastrophe. But there were also other factors at work. Systematic kidnapping and abduction, unfree labor, mass death on federal Indian reservations, hundreds of separate homicides, and over 370 individual massacres of California Indian people. This was, in fact, a case of genocide. So what do I mean when I talk about genocide? This is a hotly contested, politically explosive word. In this book, I use the 1948 United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. For a prosecutor today in an international court of law to convict a defendant of the crime of genocide, they must prove two things. First, they must prove that the defendant exhibited, beyond any reasonable shadow of a doubt, intent, what they call special intent, the intent to commit genocide. That is, the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. So that's the first part of the definition. The second part is that they have to prove, again beyond any reasonable shadow of a doubt, that the defendant also committed one of the five genocidal crimes that you see enumerated here. I use the United Nations Genocide Convention because it provides us with a clear and internationally recognized legal rubric to evaluate not only cases of genocide that happened after 1948, but also cases that happened before 1948. Following the passage of this new international legal treaty, which, by the way, passed through the UN General Assembly unanimously, which, as we know from the history of the UN, is rather unusual. It's now been signed or acceded to by almost every single state in the world. After its ratification, scholars began to rethink the conquest and colonization of California using the idea of genocide as a lens with which to look at our state's history. And by the year 2000, the dawn of the current millennium, more than 20 scholars had deemed what happened in California to indeed have been a case of genocide. So I've dedicated over 10 years of my life to writing this book. Hardback is even bigger than the softback that you have outside. It has almost 200 pages of appendices cataloging every act of homicide, both by Native people against non-Native people and non-Native people against Indian people. Why dedicate so much time to cataloging all of this violence? I think that this topic calls for particularly meticulous study and analysis because the stakes are so high. The stakes are high not only for scholars like myself, but also for California Indian people, and for all human beings who are residing in the nation that we call the United States. If United States citizens founded some regions of California, if not our state as a whole, on the deliberate attempt to physically annihilate California Indian people. Scholars like me need to reinterpret how we think about California history. We need to ask questions of basic interpretive axioms, like the fundamental assumption that California Indian people's population cataclysm was the product of introduced diseases, rather than more direct actions like homicide, like systematic institutionalized mass murder. Exceptionalist interpretations of United States history, which propose the concept that the history of the United States is somehow entirely different from the history of all other nations on Earth, come into question as we begin to compare the genocide that took place here in California to other genocides elsewhere around the world in the human experience. I'm thinking of, for example, genocide in the colonization and conquest of Australia. A careful study of the genocide that took place here in California will also assist scholars like me in re-examining the larger hemispheric indigenous population catastrophe that took place throughout the Americas. Where scholars document a genocide, it becomes necessary to evaluate what roles government and private individuals played, as well as whether or not systematic violence was only a regional phenomenon or something that took place more widely, for example, on a national or even on a continental or hemispheric scale. Larger questions then follow. What tended to catalyze genocide? Who ordered the killing? Who bloodied their hands, killing women, babies, children, and the elderly? Why do we not know more about these events in the Americas? Did democracy drive the process of mass murder? And ultimately, what role did genocide play in the making of the modern United States, Canada, Mexico, and the other nation states of the Americas? The question of genocide is particularly urgent and pressing for California's approximately 150,000 California Indian people. Should they press for official government apologies, reparations, or control of the lands where genocidal events took place? Will tribes marshal evidence of genocide in legal court cases involving municipal, county, state, or government entities? Should they use evidence of genocide in cases involving tribal sovereignty or federal recognition? How should California Indian individuals and communities commemorate the victims of mass murder while also emphasizing successful resistance, accommodation, survival, and the cultural renewal that we see throughout much of California's Indian country today? The psychological issues are also fraught. What happens when a tribal member learns that she is the descendant of both genocide perpetrators on the one hand and genocide survivors on the other, as is all too often the case? How might California Indian individuals and tribal communities reconcile increased knowledge of the genocide that took place in this state, sometimes at the hands of federal government officials and with the support and sanction of the United States Congress, with their often intense patriotism? Finally, and perhaps most importantly, what role might a better understanding of genocide play in addressing intergenerational and historical trauma? Intergenerational and historical trauma that is prevalent in many California Indian communities today, and that many link to present-day physical illnesses, substance abuse, domestic violence, and the highest rates of teen suicide of all recorded groups in California. But the question of genocide here in California has profound meaning, not only for scholars and for California Indian people, but for all of us living here in the United States. Should government officials tender public apologies, as did Presidents Ronald Reagan and George Herbert Walker Bush, for the forcible relocation and internment of over 120,000 Japanese Americans during the Second World War, many of them, by the way, citizens of the state of California. Should federal officials offer monetary compensation or reparations along the lines of the more than $1.6 billion that the United States Congress has now paid out to Japanese Americans and their heirs involved in this forcible internment? Might the officials of our state, the state of California, decrease their cut of California Indian gaming communities' $7.3 billion a year revenue as a way of paying reparations for the state of California's direct involvement in the genocide that took place here? A better understanding of the genocide that happened in California might also impact the federal government's dealings with the scores of California Indian communities, 72 by my last count, who are currently seeking recognition as American Indian tribal nations from the federal government. The question of commemoration is then closely linked. Will non-Indian people support or even tolerate the same kinds of public commemoration of mass murders committed by the state's forefathers as they do for museums, monuments, days of remembrance that are currently being celebrated to commemorate the Armenian genocide or the European Holocaust? Will genocides against California Indian people join these canonical mass murders in our public school curricula or in our wider public discourse? These questions are all extremely important, but they can only be addressed in very limited ways without a comprehensive understanding of the state-sponsored mass violence that spread like a bloodstain across California between 1846 and 1873. Sporadic mass killings of California Indians punctuated the initial years of U.S. rule in California, but it was James Marshall's famous, or infamous, depending upon your perspective, gold strike in January of 1848 that precipitated a local genocide. Oregon men moving south from Oregon Territory to take advantage of California's glittering possibilities dramatically increased violence against indigenous people. They rarely had any connection to California's colonial economy and society in which California Indian people played important roles. And many of these prospectors from Oregon saw the indigenous people of California as little more than dangerous obstacles to the rapid acquisition of wealth. In 1849, Oregonian attacks on California Indian people increased in both frequency and lethality, particularly in this area here, the central mines, where the gold rush first boomed. One 49er explained in a journal entry that I found, and I quote, "Oregon people had been used to shooting Indians, and in California, they did shoot them freely. That April, a prospector named Theodore Johnson entered the epicenter of this local genocide, Cullama, where Sutter had first found gold with John Marshall. In the central mines, Johnson and others reported massacres, homicides, systematic rapes, scalpings, and beheadings of California Indian people." Now, due to spotty primary source coverage, there were not yet any newspapers in the central mines at this time. We will never know the precise number of California Indian people murdered by newcomers in and around the mines in 1849 and early 1850. But hundreds, if not thousands, of California Indian people were killed during this time. What was clear to all of the observers was the exterminatory nature of such killings, not only in their intent, but also in their impact on California Indian communities. In December of 1849, Pomo and Wapo Indian people who were being held as unfree laborers on the western shores of Clear Lake, near what is now Kelseyville, rose up and killed the two white men who were holding them as slaves. Now, in response to this double homicide, vigilantes and United States Army soldiers killed as many as 1,000 Indian people or more between Christmas Day, 1849, and May 15th, 1850, relatively short period. Vigilantes first murdered and massacred large numbers of California Indian ranch hands and farm workers in what is now the Sonoma Valley and the Napa Valley. The area is famous for their wine production. Then, after authorities arrested some of these vigilantes, California's Supreme Court, in its very first case, let all eight men go on bail and never sought to actually try them. Meanwhile, the United States Army also sought to avenge the deaths of the two white slave owners. In a San Francisco newspaper article titled "Horrible Slaughter of Indians," one journalist described a massacre committed by the United States Army on an island in the north end of Clear Lake using information provided to them directly by a regular United States Army captain. And I quote, "Little or no resistance was encountered, and the work of butchery was of but short duration. Neither sex nor age was spared. It was the order of extermination, fearfully obeyed," end quote. As many as 800 California Indian people, almost exclusively women, children, and elders, died that morning. Other killings followed, and the officers involved were not censured. In fact, all of them received promotions. Three of them became U.S. Army generals. One of them became later the governor of the state of California. A new factor was at work. Large-scale, extended vigilante and United States Army operations tolerated by both state and federal authorities. As the gold rush continued, newcomers surged into California in search of gold. Before the rush, there were not more than 13,000 or 14,000 non-Indian people in the entire state of California, but there were over 150,000 California Indians. The newcomers came in search of wealth, but in seeking to access gold, eat, dress, acquire labor, and satisfy their sexual desires, they placed immense pressures upon California Indian communities. These demands triggered explosions in ranching, commercial hunting, gold mining, and slave raiding. These activities generated shockwaves that had a devastating impact on California Indians. But it is a mistake to think that the situation in California was simply created by rogue actors. California's new leaders magnify that impact. Under martial law, United States Army military officers in charge of ruling California turned California Indians legally into second-class subjects with few or no rights. California's first constitution, created here in Colton Hall, a museum that you can still visit today in Monterey, then decided to make it nearly impossible for California Indians to vote. A few months later, in early 1850, California's first legislators banned all Indians from voting. They barred Indians with one half of Indian blood or more from giving evidence for or against whites in criminal cases, and they banned all Indians from serving as jurors. Soon thereafter, they barred all Indians from serving as judges or attorneys. So in combination, these laws largely shut Indian people out of participation in and protection by the state's legal system. Abduction played a major role in the California Indian population catastrophe. As early as 1850, legislators passed the infamous Act for the Government and Protection of Indians, which legalized white custody of Indian minors and Indian prisoner leasing while allowing courts and juries to summarily reject all Indian testimony. Indian people could thus be forced into unpaid work for extended periods on trumped-up charges. We're looking at something here that pertains particularly to the history of Southern California. This is actually an advertisement, a handbill that would have been posted on the side of a building for the sale of a California Indian human being. In this case, a 16-year-old Southern California Indian female at the price of a pound of gunpowder and a bottle of brandy. 10 years later, in 1860, California legislators expanded that original act to legalize the indenture of absolutely any Indian. These laws then triggered a boom in violent kidnappings while separating women and men during peak reproductive years, both of which accelerated population decline. So imagine all of us are a California Indian community, perhaps in Southern California. The slave raiders would burst in through all of the doors of this auditorium, and the first thing that they would do would be to kill almost all of the men in here. Older women probably also would be killed. Those of you who are not in those categories would be tied up and taken away. Typically, anybody who resisted would be shot or stabbed to death or hanged on the spot, including children who were too tired to travel the distance that the slavers wanted them to go. In addition, once people became ensnared in these systems of servitude, they were often treated as disposable laborers. One Los Angeles lawyer recalled, and I quote, "Los Angeles had its slave mart, and thousands of honest, useful people were absolutely destroyed in this way. Indeed, between 1850 and 1870, census takers tell us that the Indian population in Los Angeles plummeted from 3,693 to just 219 individuals. Escape was one way that California Indian people defied servitude, but whites often responded with lethal force. The Wailaki Lasik Indian woman Lucy Young, who escaped servitude multiple times, recollected, and I quote, "Young woman been stole by white people, come back, shot through lights and liver. Front skin hang down like apron. She tie up with cotton dress, never die neither." Others were less fortunate. After one Northern California Indian woman fled her, quote, "lord and master with his Indian boy," end quote, in 1858, whites responded by massacring her entire village, some 15 people. 2 years later, a rancher in northwestern California became so incensed when his Indian servant visited his family half a mile away that he, quote, "slaughtered the whole family, 6 persons. Boy and all." Despite such reports, which appear with alarming frequency in California's newspapers, personal letters, and journals of the era, policymakers failed to intervene, while almost all law enforcement officials turned a blind eye. The United States Congress, meanwhile, made California Indian people particularly vulnerable to immigration's blast. In 1851 and 1852, these gentlemen that you see in the front row of this portrait here, they signed 18 separate treaties with 119 California Indian tribal communities, allocating them 7,488,000 acres. Those are the gray areas inside the white that you see on this map. It was almost 7.5% of the total land area of California. But when these treaties reached the United States Senate, the U.S. senators repudiated all of the treaties. Instead, in 1853, Congress authorized 5 military reservations not to exceed 25,000 acres each and conferred no legal title or land recognition on California Indian people. So we go from 7,488,000 acres to a maximum of 125,000 acres. The results were fourfold. First, no reservations were patented, and jurisdiction over them was left uncertain. Second, because jurisdiction remained uncertain, confusion and conflict between and among state and federal authorities prevailed. Third, it's very important, California Indian people did not become the explicit legal wards of the United States government. Finally, the United States Army determined that because this land had not been patented as positively federal land, regular United States Army soldiers did not have the right or ability to arrest whites on these temporary reservations, even when they caught them in the act of kidnapping, rape, or murder. Federal officials thus made California Indian people vulnerable to kidnapping, sexual assault, slavery, homicide, and mass murder. But the establishment of California's state militia system now marked the rise of a state-sponsored killing machine. Between the years 1850 and 1861, 3,414 white men volunteered to join California state militia units, and they carried out 24 separate Indian hunting expeditions from the far southern parts of the state to the far northern parts of the state, all the way out to the Colorado River and into the eastern portions of our state. They killed at least, at an absolute minimum, 1,342 California Indian people. But their impact transcended these numbers. Militiamen served as a widely publicized state endorsement of Indian killing, communicating an unofficial grant of legal impunity to would-be Indian killers, and inspiring many more vigilante killings. Indeed, vigilantes killed at an absolute minimum at least 6,400 California Indian people during these years. As I was doing my research, it seemed to me at first that this couldn't possibly be something that was being directed by the state. But it was. In January of 1851, this charming gentleman here, California Governor Peter Burnett, declared to the joint houses of the California Senate and Assembly, and I quote, that a war of extermination will continue to be waged until the Indian race becomes extinct. Sounds like the words of a madman. But the very next month, state legislators put the power of the purse behind his words. They voted overwhelmingly to borrow $500,000, a huge amount of money, for past and future Indian hunting operations. Meanwhile, the state of California began building up an arsenal of muskets, rifles, pistols, musketoons, sabers, cavalry swords, and many thousands of rounds of ammunition donated to them for free by the United States Army. Then, in 1852, United States Senator John Weller, representing California, a man who became California's state governor in 1858, told his fellow United States senators publicly that California Indians, quote, will be exterminated. He insisted, the interest of the white man demands their extermination. That same year, the state found that they had already run through the entire $500,000 that they had raised, and so they passed a $600,000 bond measure to support additional militia operations. What we're looking at here is an actual bond. The coupons have been detached. The bondholder would go to the financial institution, turn in the coupon, and receive a 7.5% interest payment, guaranteed by the state, a very remunerative and safe investment. We're looking here at a $250 bond, but they came in larger denominations and in much smaller denominations, making it possible not only for institutional investors like Wells Fargo to invest, but also for individuals to support and be part of this state-sponsored killing campaign. The Sinkione woman, Sally Bell, from Northwestern California, provided a rare California Indian eyewitness account of a massacre that took place in her village sometime in the middle 1850s. Bell remembered, about 10 o'clock in the morning, some white men came. They killed my grandfather and my mother and my father. I saw them do it. Then they killed my baby sister and cut her heart out and threw it into the brush where I had run to hide. My little sister was just a baby, just crawling around. I didn't know what to do. I guess I was so scared I just hid there for a long, long time with my little sister's heart in my hands. It was a terrifying time to be a California Indian. The United States Congress now endorsed such killings. In 1854, our Congress, the Congress of the United States, voted to reimburse the state of California over $924,000 to pay for their past militia campaigns against California Indian people. Even as state and federal officials worked to perfect the killing machine, the following year, this gentleman, California State Quartermaster and Adjutant General William C. Kibbe, who ran the California militia system from 1852 through the end of 1863, underscored the militia's genocidal purpose in a letter to the State Assembly and State Senate. He wrote in his annual report, "There are but two alternatives before us, viz., either to wage a war of extermination or to abandon a large and productive territory." To help perfect his killing machine, Kibbe wrote, had published, and then distributed a manual of militia tactics to all of his officers. Meanwhile, then Secretary of War Jefferson C. Davis would later become President of the Confederate States, sent Kibbe U.S. Army tactical manuals to distribute to his militiamen as Christmas gifts. Then in 1857, having now burned through the first $1.1 million that they had raised, state legislators raised an additional $410,000 for more militia operations with predictable results. Finally, in 1861, even as the Union was being torn apart, the United States Congress appropriated another $400,000 to help the state of California with the militia expenses that it had incurred in Indian hunting operations. Civilians and state and federal officials also carried out large force removal operations against California Indians to place survivors of the massacres and killing campaigns onto federal reservations. And these operations were also quite lethal. In 1861, for example, vigilantes massacred 55 California Indian people while forcibly removing one group to the Mendocino Reservation on the Redwood Coast. The late Yakuts woman Yoy Mutt recollected that during the forced removal of her community to the Fresno Reservation in the San Joaquin River Valley, soldiers first killed a dozen Indians and then at least 10 more during the forced march. Likewise, the Nome Lackey man Andrew Freeman explained that when they took the Indian people to the Round Valley Reservation in Mendocino County, they drove them like stock, and they shot the old people who couldn't make the trip. They would shoot children who were getting tired. Once at these federal reservations, California Indian people often encountered institutionalized malnutrition and lethal starvation. The Concow leader, Tomayanem, recollected that after volunteers had forcibly removed his people to the Mendocino Reservation, quote, "We were very hungry, and the Concows began to die very fast." Other reservations proved little better. In the beginning of 1860, Tomayanem led his people south to the Round Valley Reservation in hopes of finding food there, but he determined that there was even less to eat. And he was not exaggerating. In the year 1860, federal officials at Round Valley typically provided working Indians on the reservation with 480 to 910 calories per day. 2 years later, the formal official records tell us that daily rations there had fallen to 160 to 390 calories per day to working Round Valley Reservation Indians, and that those who were sick and could not work received no ration. Further diminishing these inadequate food supplies, Many of the reservation agents determined that no meat could be fed to California Indian prisoners. Now, if some California Indian people died of outright starvation, many others perished because malnutrition weakens the immune system, making it difficult for the human body to fight off lethal diseases. This became even more the case on California reservations, where there was very little clothing, very few blankets, and never enough housing, with people routinely sleeping in the mud or on the dirt. Also, starvation and malnutrition also predictably lowered fecundity while increasing the number of miscarriages and stillbirths. Some reservation colonists and federal employees also used reservation Indian people as forced disposable laborers with lethal results. For example, according to one colonist's testimony in a court of law, and I quote, about 300 people died on the Round Valley Reservation during the winter of 1856 to 1857 from the effects of packing them through the snow and mud in the mountains. They were generally worked completely naked and packed 50 pounds each, if able. So at California's federal reservations, willful neglect claimed an untold number of human lives. Federal employees also killed large numbers of California Indian people in more direct ways. During the United States Civil War, 15,725 California men volunteered to join the Union Army. Many of them joined en masse as a whole militia unit. Thousands remained in California, and they soon transformed California's killing machine. As U.S. troops, these so-called California volunteers, transformed the tradition of small, short-term Indian hunting operations with limited resources into much larger Indian hunting operations with no time frame. They could stay in the field indefinitely, and they had all the supplies available to the United States Army in a time of war. So the Army now fielded the longest and most sustained operations against California Indians. Vigilantes also flourished alongside these campaigns, but during the Civil War, the genocide became almost exclusively a federal project, and U.S. Army forces killed substantial numbers. The California Volunteers' very first campaign in northwestern California in 1862 killed 120 California Indian people in less than 2 weeks. Hundreds more would die in succeeding campaigns led by professional Army soldiers like this man, Henry M. Black. California volunteers also killed surrendered California Indian people on multiple occasions. The cavalry captain Moses McLaughlin proudly reported from just east of what is now Bakersfield how in 1863, quote, I had all the bucks collected together and 35 were either shot or sabered. None escaped. McLaughlin concluded with only thinly veiled genocidal sentiments. They will soon all be either killed off or pushed so far into the deserts that they shall perish by absolute famine. The United States Army continued killing California Indians through the entirety of the Civil War and even into the 1870s. After officers concluded their final U.S. Army Indian hunting operation, the 1872-1873 Modoc War, they hanged and beheaded four surrendered Modoc leaders before shipping their severed heads to U.S. Army medical collection in our nation's capital. The California Indian catastrophe then quite neatly fits the two-part legal definition set forth in the United Nations Genocide Convention. First, perpetrators demonstrated in both word and in deed intent to destroy. Second, they committed not one, but all five of the genocidal acts enumerated in the convention. Killing occurred in more than 370 massacres, as well as hundreds of smaller killings, homicides, and executions. Sources indicate that from 1846 to 1873, vigilantes, militiamen, and soldiers killed at least 9,492 to to 16,094 California Indian people, and probably many, many more. By way of contrast, California Indians killed fewer than 1,500 non-Indian people during this entire time frame. But other acts of genocide proliferated too. Many rapes and beatings occurred, and these meet the convention's definition of causing serious bodily harm to victims on the basis of their group identity and with the intent to destroy the group. The sustained military and civilian policy of systematically demolishing, usually with fire, California Indian villages and then destroying their tools and food supplies while driving survivors into inhospitable mountain and desert regions amounted to deliberately inflicting upon the group conditions of life intended to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And some Office of Indian Affairs employees administering federal reservations committed the same genocidal crime. Further, because malnutrition and exposure quite predictably lowered birth rates, some state and federal decision makers also appear guilty of imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. Finally, the state, individual slave raiders, and federal officials were all very much involved in forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Indeed, 3,000 to 4,000 or more California Indian children suffered such forced transfers during this period. By breaking up families and shattering whole communities, forced removals also constituted imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. So sufficient evidence exists to designate the California Indian catastrophe indeed as a case of genocide. Elected California officials were the primary architects of this man-made catastrophe. But the U.S. Army also played an important role, first creating the exclusionary legal system, setting genocidal precedents, helping to build up and arm the killing machine, directly participating in killing, and finally taking total control of it. In total, United States military forces killed at least 1,688 to 3,741 California Indian people during this period. But if state legislators were the architects, federal officials did help to lay the groundwork. They became the final arbiters of the design, and they ultimately paid for almost all of its official execution. By the year 1863, the United States Congress had given the state of California well over $1 million to pay for Indian hunting campaigns by the militia. And of course, by 1863, the United States Army had taken over as the primary killers, and Congress controlled that institution's budget as well. Indeed, federal legislators, it turned out, sitting in Washington, D.C., paid for most of the many lethal campaigns against California Indians that began in 1846 and concluded only in 1873. We're looking here at one of the only extant images that we have that is a primary source image depicting a massacre in progress. This one made by Special Treasury Agent J. Ross Brown and showing a nighttime lit by a full moon massacre of a Yuki Indian village in what is now southern Mendocino County. Like California Indians, Native American people across this country suffered devastating population losses following the invasion by newcomers. Before contact, perhaps 5 million or more Native American people inhabited what is now the continental United States. But by the year 1900, census takers counted fewer than 250,000 survivors. What caused this catastrophe? Diseases, colonialism, and war all played a part, but was something more sinister also to blame? Academics and others have long debated whether or not Native Americans or any particular tribal nations suffered genocide during the conquest and colonization of the Americas. But there are two factors that essentially polarize this debate. First, there's widespread disagreement over what genocide is. Secondly, there's widespread disagreement about what the time frame or the unit of geographic analysis ought to be. I think that this is a case of lumping everything together when what is needed is to carefully split things apart and undertake the kind of detailed case study that I've done in California to understand precisely what happened in a particular time and place. The direct and deliberate killing of California Indian people between 1846 and 1873 seems to have been more sustained and more lethal than anywhere else in the history of the United States or its colonial antecedents. But there remains, as I said before, a pressing need for additional detailed case studies of particular regions, times, and American Indian peoples within and beyond the United States. The United Nations Genocide Convention provides scholars and thinkers with a standardized, internationally recognized legal rubric and a coherent definition that we can apply consistently across both time and space. Scholars should rigorously evaluate each and every potential case in consistent terms, not just in the United States, but throughout the world. Native American people experienced and reacted to colonialism in varied ways. Rigorously examining this range of human experiences, using the Genocide Convention to evaluate both potential genocidal intent and genocidal acts, can help us to carefully think through the question of genocide, not only in the history of the United States, but in the history of the Americas and other colonized places around the world. Unbraiding each region's story from the tapestry of American Indian history and bringing each into sharper relief will create a clearer, more vivid portrait of Native American experiences and of the Western Hemisphere as a whole. Such investigations will be painful. We cannot bring back the dead. But they will help all Americans, both Native and non-Native, to make more accurate sense of our past and ourselves. Thank you. Thank you. So I would now like to welcome back to the podium my good friend Julia Bogany, where she will read to us a short story by the author, scholar, and Grayton Rancheria Chairman Greg Saris, who very sadly could not be here this evening due to events entirely beyond his control.
Thank you. The day was beautiful and warm. Twin sisters question woman and answer woman continue sitting atop the fence rail on Gravity Hill. It was spring. Birds sang. Cows in the distance grazed. Sonoma Mountain was awash in spectacular color. I am thinking of so many things after hearing about how coyote created people, said question woman. And I am confused. Are you and I people, or are we crows? We are all people still, answered answer woman. Some of us took the form of animals, some of us the form of human beings. But the point is, we are all relatives. We are all related. We have eyes and ears. We all talk. We all have stories. We come from the same village. After all, that is the lesson of this mountain. But people can't hear us. I mean, they hear us, but they don't know what we are saying. That man just rode by on his bicycle. He might hear us squawk, but he doesn't know what we are saying. The old people of the village, the human descendants of coyote, they could understand the animals. They communicated with the animals and plants through song and dreams, and of course through the story. You see, in the stories, we are always both human and animals. That is, we are all people. But the newest people, the people who left this mountain and then came back, many of them are called the forgetters, the humans who forgot the stories of this mountain. What happened? They went away, settled in places all over the world with the stories that they could use for whatever they settled. They could change the stories to suit the places. They settled as long as the stories taught them and the same lessons that we are all one people, animals, plants, human beings, and that we must always think of and remember one another that way. Oh, yes, that makes me think of what you said a while back before the last story. I asked where the cows and starling came from and the wild turkeys. Yes, so it was these forgotten people who brought them. Yes, sister, that is right. Many things happen when the forgetters people return here. They brought new animals and plants, yes, but the forgetters also killed all of the bears and all the elk and the pronghorn. They cut down trees, you see. They forgot the stories. They forgot we are all people. And the animals, indeed, the entire mountain began to suffer. Now we must all try to learn to live together. We must all remember the stories again. But how? Well, we must tell the stories and ask that everyone learn from them. People can always change the stories to suit their needs, as long as the stories teach the same lessons of love and respect for all life. The stories can change. Of course, I said, so already, the stories already changed from different times and different places. Like what? Give me an example. Well, let's take the first story I told you. Do you remember that story? Have you forgotten? I am question woman. I forget things. Oh, yes. Well, it was the story about the pretty woman and the necklace. Oh, I do remember now. She wanted a necklace to impress a man in the village at the edge of Katati Plain. Right. See, she was a human being. Yes. So let's go back to the beginning of the stories I told you. Let's go back to that first story. We will add to it so that it makes sense and connects to all the stories I told you. How are you going to do that? I'm going to tell you a story. What story? Listen.
Thank you very much, Julia. It's a beautiful story. So we have some time to take questions about the book. I'd be happy to answer what I can. And the gentleman in the front, we'll bring a microphone down to you. Okay.
You stated that this war of extermination was approved and supported by the local, state, and federal governments. And you said this was because it was in the interests of the white man. What were those approved or accepted interests of the white man?
Well, yes, so you're quoting from Senator and then Governor Weller, who made that statement that this was the interest of the white man demanded this extermination. One of the things that happened in California that is rather unusual in the history of Western states is the very rapid migration of people. So the single greatest mass migration of the 19th century in the United States is to California. So the population of non-native people goes from 13 or 14,000 before the gold rush to over 360,000 by 1860, and it just keeps on surging ever upward. This provided a group of people who had tremendous demands for land, for food, areas on which to farm and ranch cattle, and that coincides and was driven by the gold rush. So there's a great desire to access the wealth of California through its gold. That provided so much revenue that state officials, state senators, state assemblymen, and state governors were quite explicit in their belief that the federal government would have to repay them for anything that they undertook that would produce more gold. Why? Because remember what the gold rush does in the history of the United States and the world. It increases in our country the amount of specie in circulation some 20-fold. It provides the money for massive national infrastructure projects like the Transcontinental Railroad. It provides the money that helps to push forward the Industrial Revolution in the eastern United States. It even provides the money for Garibaldi's campaign to unify Italy. It provides huge amounts of money that go into southern China, particularly into Guangzhou province. So this is a massive transformative event, and the politicians in California were quite clear that they could spend as much as they wanted and that the federal treasury and Congress would give them everything they needed. And that proved to be correct. So the expenditures on state militia operations were always far and away the single largest line item in any California state budget during the 1850s. And they could undertake this financial risk primarily because they believed that the federal government would reimburse them. So two of the main drivers of this story are mass migration, another one is the gold rush itself, and another is the fact that these people coming either by ship from around the world or overland were very heavily armed. They brought a huge number of weapons with them. There's one story in the book about a group of people who came from what is now West Virginia. They towed a 6-pounder cannon all the way across the United States. And when they got to Sacramento, everyone was laughing at them. And they encountered no hostile Indians. Remember, most people on the overland trails encounter zero hostility from Indian people. You were 10 to 20 times more likely to die of cholera than you were of violence at the hands of indigenous peoples. So they brought this cannon all the way across the country, but it's symbolic of the huge numbers of weapons that people brought. If we go back here to this slide of the heavily armed miner. Oh, no, shut up. Okay. So many people brought, an individual person would bring a rifle, a musket, a brace of pistols, maybe also a shotgun, and some knives. So people came heavily armed, and they also came predisposed to hate Indians. Why? Because the literature of the day, both the fiction and the journalistic reportage, had calibrated the lenses of these newcomers to be filled with hate, suspicion, and fear toward indigenous peoples. So sometimes they just show up, and for no reason, they slaughter a whole village. And a bystander writes, "I couldn't understand why they did it," and I asked them, and they said, "We wanted to try out our weapons that we carried all the way across the country, and isn't this what everybody else is doing?" So, but the book has many more explanations, just a superficial sense of what's going on there.
Thank you, Mr. Madley, for your great talk, and what an incredible work you've done with your book. I haven't read in it deeply. I hope you found some joy in the last 10 years as you were trying to put that all together.
There's the miracle of survival. Let me just say that, because that's what Greg was going to talk about. So this specter of genocide haunts the land of the endless summer, the land of Disneyland, the land of Beach Boys and hard-body surfers. It's all around us, but we've forgotten. And what Greg would say, I think, if I can be so bold, is he would say, we have to restory California. We have to restory America to understand that the history here is so much deeper than what we think we know. We don't get anything about California Indian history for our kids. I mean, I'm watching my kids go through it, and it's infuriating. If you hold out your arm, everybody just hold out your arm for a second, humor me. All of this is human experience and human history in California. The only part that involves people who look like me is this white part of your fingernail. So we're spending all of our energy building monuments and teaching children about this little tiny part of California history when we live in one of the most magnificently diverse places on the earth in terms of human culture. Over 100 different languages are spoken here, indigenous California languages, as different to each other as Cantonese is from French today. Over 60 different major tribal nations with many different rich culinary traditions, religious belief systems, stories. I mean, Greg's written a whole book just of Coast Miwok and Southern Pomo stories that just kind of barely scratches the surfaces of what is there. So the fact that people survive against almost impossible odds is what gave me a lot of joy. And as I traveled to California Indian communities up and down the state, trying to verify my findings, learn oral histories, get an understanding of what things I shouldn't talk about, I was blown away by people who were in communities that walked right up to the brink of extinction and looked over the edge and had found all these brilliant, phenomenal ways to avoid being destroyed. It's incredible that languages are intact. Cultural traditions are intact. When I show the pictures from the book to California Indian communities, people tell me, I know that person. That's my great-great-great-grandmother, and this is her name. And here's the family tree. Let me tell you about it. So that story of human persistence and survival is something that gave me joy. And I want to be clear about that, because Greg would have spoken about this much more eloquently than I can and at more length. But I want to acknowledge that that's there.
I just had two quick questions.
Yes. One, I always had the idea that California Indians were much more docile and peaceful, and because maybe they hadn't had the exposure to white America and European Americans, and maybe that's just a silly trope. And I'm wondering if the Seminole Wars added to that with the federal government feeling about what they how they had to handle Indians, because they weren't allowed to defeat the Seminoles. The other thing is there a monument, a plaque, anything in California that talks about or that acknowledges the genocide that happened to American Indians?
So I'll take the first question first. Well, I think there's no really easy answer to that question. In terms of monuments, there have been monuments. There have been monuments that have been destroyed. For example, near Hay Fork, where I lived as a very small kid, there's a place where a huge massacre of Wintu people took place. It's known as the Peanut Massacre or the Bridge Gulch Massacre, where vigilantes surrounded a village and killed over 150 people at dawn one morning. And there have been two attempts to erect monuments to that huge massacre. And both times, nobody really knows who, but both times those monuments have been destroyed. I strongly think that it's high time that we think about memorializing the victims to these atrocities by erecting more monuments to these 370-plus massacres. Now, this is happening. I talked a little bit about the Bloody Island Massacre in May of 1850, when the United States Army killed as many as 800 people on an island in northern Clear Lake. There are now two monuments that stand side by side, one of them from the 1940s, which describes this as a heroic battle, a great victory involving a number of quite famous California politicians and U.S. Army officers. Next to it is a monument from this century, from the 21st century, which is quite clear about this being a massacre. And there have been community-based approaches towards having town hall meetings to rethink what the language should or could be in these memorials. This is the same kind of discussion that we're having in the United States today about Civil War monuments. It is equally fraught. So the legacies of genocide in California are hidden in plain sight. And when we bring them into focus, it can be quite troubling. If you read this book, I think you'll come away with a very different idea of who John C. Fremont was, the first Republican candidate for the presidency. Think of all the things that you've done in California where you've been in something named after John C. Fremont. The city of Fremont in the Bay Area. Lakes, mountains. You can't go to schools. You can't go to a major U.S. City in the West, pretty much, and not drive on a Fremont Street, right? And the same is true of Weller. But things are changing. And I talk about this in the legacies section of the book at the end, in the conclusion, that there... the consciousness is changing. There are schools, you know, there used to be a Burnett School in San Francisco. Name has been changed. Used to be a Burnett School right over here in Long Beach. It's changed. Now, we just acknowledged Indigenous Peoples Day here, and we stopped acknowledging Columbus Day. So when we think about names and naming, I think this is really important. It's meaningful. Why? Because for Indigenous people, the hurt is twice. First, you erase the real people of the land and their presence. The names of the places are much, much older than any of these new colonial impositions. So there's the pain of erasure. And then on top of that, you double down on the insult and the trauma by naming it after somebody who's explicitly devoting their life to destroying Indian people and wiping out Indian culture. So I talked about the enslavement and the abuse that happened on the shores of Clear Lake. Well, the town there is named Kelseyville. It's named after the killers. And so there have been local movements, not just state movements, but local movements that change names.
I'm glad that you talked about the children and how they were affected, and one of the points being taking someone's children and indoctrinating them into your culture. Could you just touch a little bit on how the children that were raised under these Western values and taken from their Indigenous values, how that also, through the generations, affected how they felt about their parents, their sense of identity. I think we've seen through history that one of the strongest tools that you can use is taking someone's culture and their identity. And then eventually, you know, there are the mixed race case systems, and there are mestizo case systems that that affect Indigenous people, and then they may privilege themselves above their more Indigenous relatives. And we've seen this work in the African-American genocide, which we commonly refer to as slavery. So I guess if you could just touch on a little bit how, I guess, infecting those children with someone else's culture and value system and that erasure and taking theirs has also affected probably Indigenous people right up until today.
It's a great question, and I think it's a great insight, because there is a common experience that Indigenous people under colonialism have had, whether it's in North or South America or Australia. I can think of lots of different empires. Even the Nazis forcibly took children away from victim groups and tried to remake them in the mold of the colonizers' culture and life ways and religious traditions. So in California, especially in the period that I cover in the book, the forcible removal of children has a lot to do with obtaining labor. So a lot of these children ended up as laborers. They are washing clothes. They are taking care of non-native children. And it's a tradition that extends out of the Mexican and Spanish tradition of also using a lot of child labor in the colonization of California. One of the ways we can get these numbers and really see this is by looking at school enrollments, because if a California Indian child was the ward or adoptee of a non-native family, they would go to an integrated school. But if not, they would go to a separate school. So we can actually look at the annual reports of the state superintendent of schools in California, and we could see quite clearly how many California Indian children are living in states of wardship or custodianship with non-native families. So we can actually trace that process. As this book is winding down, or just after this book winds down, we get the boarding school system. And the boarding school system in California is quite violent. It's quite difficult for California Indian people. And it's about forcible removal, not into custodianship or wardship or adoption to individual non-Indian families, but to the federal government at its federal boarding schools. Most notorious, the biggest one in California was the Sherman Institute, which is just east of where we are now. So people would be taken as early as young as 5 years old, sometimes not allowed to return home until they reach the age of majority, until 18. So what did this do to people to be taken, let's say, for example, from northwestern California, in the area where I grew up, and be taken to southeastern California to be educated for over a decade? Well, this was a very concerted policy created by Richard Henry Pratt to, quote, kill the Indian and save the man. This is the explicit project of the federal government, not just here in California, but at 26 federal Indian boarding schools from Oregon all the way out to Pennsylvania, and a host of on-reservation day schools as well. So what they were trying to do was break down everything that was indigenous in a child and wipe it out and replace it with things that were white. So what did this do? As I talk about this in the introduction of the book, one of the reasons we don't have such a rich oral history of the experience of this genocide is because of the forcible removal of children. It's the intentional severing of those conduits of oral history, not just love and affection, but of oral history through which indigenous history systems are passed from elders to the youth to be carried from generation to generation. That's one thing. If you take children away from elders and parents, you can't do that. The other thing that happens, if you keep somebody away from their native language for years at a time, and you punish them speaking their native language by, for example, commonly washing the mouth out with soap, putting needles or safety pins through the tongue or through the lips, locking children in solitary confinement in the dark for a day or more at a time, you're going to break the very mechanism, the linguistic mechanism that will allow for that knowledge to be transferred between generations. But you're also going to take away from people what Greg would call the storying of the land. You're unstorying the land because for California Indian people, if I can be so bold as to summarize, every place has a meaning. So you pass by a mountain or a rock or a pool or a particular tree, all of those things are places where mnemonic memory triggers are situated so that you know a story about this tree which tells you about who you are, where you belong. And if you take people away from the places for their entire youth, they don't get to learn that information. But what's amazing to me, again, is the story of survival, that despite everything that the federal government tried to do for decades and decades, huge amounts of money, thousands of employees, a system of forcible removal that often involved the U.S. Army and local municipal and county governments to take children away. Because parents didn't just want to let their children go in many cases. They developed hiding places for them under the floorboards in the house. You know, a secret room built onto the outhouse where children could hide. Even kids going into the water and breathing through reeds when the Indian Affairs officer would come to take the children away. Even despite everything that the federal government tried to do, languages remain, traditions remain. Indigenous people today can take you through the land and show you all of those sacred places and still tell you the stories. So no matter what the federal government has tried to do, no matter what our state government has tried to do, I want to leave you with the powerful impression that I have, which is that California Indian people have survived, and that California Indian people's survival is absolutely extraordinary. California Indian people today are the descendants of genocide survivors, and the work now is to restory the land, which is, I think, what Greg wanted to talk about. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.